our system is a good system, but it's older and there's a lot of people protecting turf. They didn't have that in Mexico. It's a national license. If you become a doctor, you're licensed in the country. Hispanics are mobile first, so the mobile phone was very common. They were comfortable using it, and they weren't accustomed to getting health care in another way. They don't have the Marcus Welby type model in their mind, and so they were open to a new approach.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
The U.S. healthcare system was designed primarily based on our understanding of the biological and social needs of white men. Of course, our current society tells us that it's far more complex and that the system must recognize and respond to a diversity of gender, culture, language, and other biopsychosocial factors in order to remain truly effective.
This is Tectonics. I'm David Chewitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan. And today's episode is brought to you by DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data. And thinking about today's episode, David, I couldn't help but think about the controversies currently swirling around in our political system and about the relevance of science and the importance of a multicultural union and, well, you know, reality and what it means for our evolving healthcare system, assuming you believe in evolution and all that.
Wasn't it striking that at the convention, at the Democratic convention, they actually highlighted "we believe in science" as sort of like a platform feature, as if it was a novel thing?
Like, I believe in oxygen.
And it's not just left versus right. There was a lot of controversy recently around Jill Stein, right, of the Green Party, raising doubts about vaccines, of all things. And I think she's a doctor.
Yeah, well, you know, there's no accounting for intellect. Anyways, the fact is America has become a country made up of many cultures. And the fastest growing segment of our country is the Hispanic population, which now represents about 17% of Americans. By 2060, this is supposed to go to 30%. Over 70% of these individuals speak Spanish at home. And one who recognized this as an opportunity very early on is Abner Mason, CEO of telehealth company Consejo Sano, which serves the healthcare needs of Spanish speakers through a unique model of clinical access. Welcome, Abner.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
We're excited to have you here.
Very excited.
So since our viewers can't see you, they don't know that you're a black guy who doesn't speak Spanish, yet runs a company that uses technology to match Hispanic patients with Mexican doctors who can give them more personalized care that is culturally relevant and, of course, in their native language. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about Consejo Sano, and then let's back up and talk about how you got there.
Sure. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about Consejo Sano. What we're trying to do really is to connect Spanish speakers in the U.S. with the U.S. health system. There's an enormous amount of distrust of the U.S. health system on the part of the Spanish speakers. And although the U.S. health system is very good, it's a great health system, it is primarily English-focused. And as you mentioned earlier, Lisa, about 70% of Hispanics in the United States either only speak Spanish or are more comfortable in Spanish. And so when they're talking about any kind of health issue, they're going to want to speak Spanish. So, you know, the question for us was, what do you do when you have a huge and growing part of the population that is just disconnected to the U.S. health system? Well, you need to find a way to connect them, to build a bridge between Spanish speakers and the U.S. health system. And that is what Consejo Sano does. We aren't trying to replace the U.S. health system. We're trying to build a trusted relationship between Spanish speakers and the doctors and other healthcare providers here in the U.S.
Is there a lot of distrust in your experience, or is it just not being sure how to engage because of all their usual challenges plus the language barrier?
I think it's both, and they're tied together. There's no question that you know, if you can't understand the doctor or the nurse because they're speaking a different language, there's going to be a lack of engagement and an unwillingness, or certainly not an enthusiasm, a lot of enthusiasm about going in and connecting, meeting the doctor, being, you know, connecting with the system. So there's no question that the language barrier itself is a problem. But I think, too, that for Hispanics specifically, because of some of the issues you talked about earlier in our culture right now, there's an added level of distrust. It's hard to find a Hispanic family that doesn't have someone they care about or love who's undocumented. And so we're in this environment where in the U.S. right now, although it's the fastest growing demographic, we have yet as a country to figure out how to really incorporate and absorb this part of the American family into the overall American family. It's still an ongoing process, and that leads to a significant amount of distrust.
So I know you grew up in North Carolina, ended up in Massachusetts in prep school, going to Harvard, living a different life than you started out with. One of the things that you told me was that you ran a philosophy of science club in school focused on the learnings of Karl Popper, a philosopher that I wasn't that familiar with, so I checked it out. And it was so interesting to think about that philosophical approach. And, you know, I wondered how that applies in the healthcare world in your mind. You know, are there closely held beliefs that you think will prove ultimately false in the healthcare system? Is that the basis, in fact, for what you're doing now?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. You know, when I was in college, as I said, I became very interested in Karl Popper, who was a philosopher of science, and one of his key contributions was to the philosophy of science was this idea about falsifiability being a key component of what, in his view, represented real science. That is, that if you can't, if statements can't be falsified, if they're designed in a way that no matter what, you can never falsify them, then they don't count as science. So, and I was really fascinated by that, and so I did create the Karl Popper Society at Harvard, and we would have various speakers come in. Yeah, it was a fun time, and you know, in college, you're opened up to all these new ideas, and it was just an exciting time for me. But I do think it influenced part of my thinking. I'm certainly reluctant to buy into views that can't be disproved. So I do think about that frequently, even now. I think that, you know, am I looking at something, or am I believing something, or am I setting up a situation where I'm pushing a point of view that facts cannot influence it? I really believe that we should always try as best we can to be moving in a direction and to be pushing ideas and theories and approaches that facts can influence things. And in fact, when data comes to us that is, you know, count as what we're believing or what we think we believe, I think we ought to change our point of view. So that does affect how I've approached health. You know, Consejo Sano and the healthcare system in the U.S. We sort of realized pretty quickly that there just aren't enough Spanish-speaking healthcare providers in the U.S. to meet the needs of Spanish speakers. And so we had to, you know, do something different. We had to try something different, and we had to kind of take what was considered to be absolute truth, which is that you can't, you know, use healthcare resources from across the border. We had to challenge that, and I think we did. And what we're finding is that having that kind of open-minded approach and being willing to go to where the answers are, as opposed to being fixed in one way of thinking, is a much better way to proceed.
I know you did the obligatory, you know, role at Bain Capital after leaving Harvard, but later on went into policy and ultimately got interested in the fight against HIV on a global basis. Tell us a little bit about that move from the philosophy of science, politics side into the healthcare world.
Sure. It was not an intentional transition, like a lot of things, you know.
Nothing ever is.
Exactly. It's part of their life journey. You would never have guessed you'd end up doing what you ended up doing. But basically, in short, I was, after Harvard, I got lucky enough to get a job at Bain Consulting in the Boston office. And I learned a lot about business and working with some of the large clients, one of which was a large health hospital client. So I learned a bit about healthcare. And shortly after, you know, starting at Bain, a guy ran for governor of Massachusetts, a guy named Bill Weld, and he won. And I supported him. And he said he was looking for new ideas to come into government. So I joined state government in Massachusetts, thinking it would be for a very short period of time. I made a 2-year commitment, ended up being there about, I think, 11 years. And I started in transportation because I was interested in some of the things that were happening in Massachusetts in terms of transit. And one thing led to another. I ended up being chief policy advisor after a number of years. I went up a number of positions. I ended up working for not just Weld, but his successor, Paul Salucci, and his successor, a woman named Jane Swift. And so I ended up being chief policy advisor for those, for Paul Salucci and Jane Swift. And as you might know, Massachusetts was the first state in the union to have universal health care. And some of that groundwork that ultimately came to fruition under Mitt Romney, who succeeded Jane Swift. But we did some of that groundwork in Massachusetts, so I got to learn a bit about policy at the state level in healthcare. And around during that same time, I was appointed to the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS by the Bush administration at the time. It's a group that advises the president, the secretary of health, and the secretary of state on the challenge of HIV. And at the time, it was a huge issue, not just domestically, but also internationally. And I was involved in the lead up to PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which is still today, I think, the largest health-related humanitarian relief effort by any nation that's ever happened.
I guess I have a couple of questions, but one, how did your focus on HIV and on sort of evidence-driven, it sounds like evidence-driven policy, how did that connect with, you know, my recollection was a lot of aspects of the initial debates around HIV, it wasn't my sense that everything was strictly evidence-driven. And that there seemed to be, you know, a lot in the air that was, you know, not, you know, sort of beyond the science. Was one of your functions trying to sort of bring the science to the policy debate?
At the time, it's interesting. Big picture, I would say yes, but the way to get there, or the way that we got there, was to focus at the and maybe it's a happy coincidence. The focus of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, and that whole effort was getting antiretroviral therapy, getting drugs to people in poor resource settings, particularly in Africa at the time, which is the hardest hit part of the world in terms of HIV. So we were fortunate in that since almost all of the funding was directed toward getting antiretroviral treatment to people and building the infrastructure to deliver those drugs. So it's not, you can't just hand the drug to someone. You've got to deliver the infrastructure, which means building clinics, in some cases refrigeration, adding electricity, being able to get people and check their viral loads. There was a whole lot of healthcare infrastructure that was built in order to deliver those antiretroviral drugs.
Right.
There was a double bent. So the first thing is, it was a happy coincidence because we didn't have to deal with a lot of the issues that around, you know, science versus non-science. It's mm-hmm. When your key goal is to get people drugs, you're either the way you measure it is really quite straightforward, and so it allowed us not to have to deal with a lot of peripheral issues. So that's one thing that was good. The other thing that was good is that infrastructure, which was built to deliver antiretroviral drugs, once you build some infrastructure, for instance, a clinic, a local clinic, that clinic then can provide all sorts of other healthcare services. So it has this double, triple benefit. So I still think to this day PEPFAR is just an extraordinary example of U.S. leadership in the world. You know, that was a situation where the U.S. government, which means the people of the U.S., stepped forward and at a critical moment in time and really made a huge difference.
But isn't there a big problem in the developing world because the explanatory models for illness in many of these countries are different than we might have here, and the receptivity to you know, Western, you know, medicines. I mean, there's been a little bit of a challenging history around that as well. Did you have any unexpected, in the course of delivering these treatments, did you encounter sort of any surprising resistance from people who were distrustful?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a lot of, in the early days, there was an extraordinary amount of false information, and I would say myth around.
That's what I was thinking about. I mean, and it's not that even early days. I mean, you still hear about, you know, people's, you know, warning against doing things that are, you know, are beneficial.
Yeah. So there's no question about that. And even in some countries, you know, that you had leaders, national, you know, political leaders, pushing, you know, mythological solutions, things that just weren't true. I think the thing, so that, there's no question that that was a factor, but I think the thing that made the huge difference was what we call the Lazarus effect.
That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
When people got onto therapy, they started taking the drugs, and their friends and neighbors saw them literally come back from the dead. These are people who were almost at death's door. They would get on antiretroviral therapy and they would come literally, I mean, it was miraculous. If I wish that, you know, more Americans were able, could have seen what I saw, for instance, in Uganda, and the impact of U.S. generosity. You literally people coming back to life almost from death. What that
right.
The power of that example really, I think, is the thing that did the most to dispel the myth.
So that led to your first startup, I think, right? The AIDS Responsibility Project.
That led to my first startup, and it was on the nonprofit side. But I started a nonprofit AIDS organization called AIDS Responsibility Project, because I was very committed and interested in seeing what we could, what more we could do based on what we were learning. And so when I had an opportunity it wasn't an opportunity, my boss, the governor, decided not to run. So I was out of a job. I guess you call that an opportunity.
Motivation.
Yeah. Really. So an opportunity was created for me that I had to do something new. And so I thought, I really like what I'm doing. And I feel like I can make more of a difference here. And so I created AIDS Responsibility Project as a not-for-profit organization designed to really see what lessons we could learn and find unique opportunities to add value to the global fight against HIV. And we ended up, after some work, focusing primarily on workplace discrimination. As it turns out, that was a big issue, particularly in Latin America, particularly in Mexico, which is how I first started doing work there.
This is what got you to Mexico and into the whole Hispanic community to begin with, right?
Exactly. So it was not, interestingly, this is how life is funny. It takes you in different directions. I was really interested in Africa, and so I was when I first created AIDS Responsibility Project, the nonprofit, the first work we did was in Africa. But because there was so much successful work being done in Africa and a lot of new money flowing from the U.S. because of PEPFAR, what happened was other parts of the world, in particular Latin America, were not seeing increases in funding, were not seeing increases in new programs. In fact, saw some cuts in funding. So I had some friends who worked at USAID, which is part of the State Department, which is responsible for doing this kind of development work in Latin America. And they said, look, Abner, can you do something? Let's come up with something that we can do in Latin America. So we put together a congressional staff CODEL, took some key staffers from Congress to visit three countries, Mexico, Brazil, and Jamaica, and looked at HIV/AIDS programs in the Americas. And what we realized was a common theme was enormous stigma and discrimination in the workplace. And that's when I decided that that was a place that we could focus. And so we built the first business council on HIV and AIDS in Mexico. It was funded initially by the State Department, by USAID, and then subsequently by the private sector. We partnered with the government of Mexico. It was so successful, the USAID asked us to do something similar in Jamaica. So we created the first business council on HIV and AIDS in Jamaica as well. And both were incredibly successful efforts that really, I think, made a difference in those countries.
So as you were working with the employers in Mexico, you know, I think similar to your African experience, it seems to me you had a platform built, you know, as a result of your AIDS work, but that led to the wellness work that you also did. You know, you're able to leverage that into a different kind of business.
Yeah, you know, as I said, I was at the time running AIDS Responsibility Project. We were working as it was a nonprofit. We were helping companies to deal specifically with the issue of HIV/AIDS discrimination and stigma in the workplace. And I can tell you, at that time, this was in 2000 and 2002 and 3 and 4, there was enormous problems in terms of stigma in the workplace. And so we were able to work with companies to change policies. Very successful effort. But what happened is the companies we were working with, they liked what we were doing. But they said to me, you're just talking about HIV. And this is in Mexico. They said, you're just talking about HIV. Why can't you help us with diabetes and obesity and high cholesterol and all of these sort of chronic conditions that are increasingly driving our healthcare costs and driving our people to be sick? So my partners and I decided to listen to what we were hearing from the companies, and we made a big change, a big decision. We decided to create a for-profit company that would basically be a corporate wellness consulting firm in Mexico. And we would help companies in Mexico to improve employee health by designing and implementing and evaluating wellness programs for their employees. It was a new idea.
What year was that?
We created it in 2009.
Okay, so that was pretty early in the whole wellness company development phase. I mean, here in the U.S., it was just getting started.
And it was definitely just getting started in Mexico. In fact, we would go to people, because we had had a successful relationship with a lot of companies through the HIV/AIDS work, we were now able to at least get in the door in the office of decision makers, but they would frequently say to us, we're not sure what you're talking about, wellness, and you know, why is that our responsibility? We pay these people, they have a salary, why should we But at the same time, they were saying to us,
"What did you answer? What did you answer? Because it seems to me, in many ways, an unanswered question. In U.S. as well, what did you see as the goal of wellness? What did you tell them when they say, what is it and why should we care?
Usually, we would say two things. We would say, talk to your CFO. And ask them what poor health is costing them, both in terms of additional insurance costs, because in Mexico it's a little different from our system. The companies have to pay into the government for all employees, but then on top of that they have to have private plans for white collar workers, and increasingly more and more of their employees are insisting on the additional plan. So the companies are sort of double paying for everyone, double paying for others, and then they're being hit by costs associated with poor health, absenteeism, and other kinds of health related costs. So we would say one thing, let's look at the cost, and then second, we would say, let's look at what kind of company you want to be in terms of attracting the best talent. In Mexico, it was and still remains a race for talent. And so we made the case that you can both save money and be a preferred employer if you have a robust wellness program. So it's saving money and attracting people.
I mean, it really struck me that those are two distinct tracks. I mean, even for wellness in the U.S. And I think my sense here is the wellness as a thing that a good employer does to attract talent, that if you have reimburse yoga classes, you're more likely to get better employees, say, in California anyway. But versus, on the other hand, in other words, the question is, I was really surprised when you just said that, you would actually talk to a CFO essentially saying, well, we can give you an ROI on this, because my understanding is efforts to deliver a measurable ROI for wellness, certainly if you talk to Al Lewis, he would say, also in Boston, be incredibly skeptical about, studies done robustly ever demonstrating true ROI for corporate wellness programs. On the other hand, the idea of creating an environment that you would want an employer, that you want as a company, as you want to recruit talent, my sense is that wellness has evolved from here's a hard ROI and that we're going to take all this, absenteeism, and then, I remember from consulting, presenteeism, and it's like, very soft and squishy numbers, and we're going to improve that. That just seems like an incredible challenge. I'm not sure anyone has really crossed. But on the other hand, being able to do it has really made a difference for attracting talent. What has your experience been along both of those lines?
There's no question. You're right that it's much easier to make the case and to actually demonstrate in a measurable way that wellness programs can make employers more attractive, employees, sort of preferred employers, so easier to attract and retain the best talent. So I think you're right. There's no question that's easier. When it comes to building an ROI, that is more difficult. And so one of the things we started to, for instance, work with insurance companies that were providing the major medical plans to the corporations. And we were able to create discounts for companies that implemented wellness programs, that joined the Wellness Council. We called it the Workplace Wellness Council of Mexico, that demonstrated that they were implementing wellness programs. They could get a discount from the health plan that the company contracted with. So it's kind of, maybe it was kind of a shortcut, a cheating way to get an immediate ROI. We had to be creative, because you're right, it takes time. I think there is an ROI for improving health, no question, but it's a longer term sort of thing. So what we had to do was, we had to be creative and create short term, almost like this fiscal year, gains for people to take action to improve employee health. And we did. And those kinds of things have been helpful.
One of the things you told me you learned or observed in this whole thing and led to the formation of Consejo Sano is what you called reverse innovation, that some of the new things that were available to the folks in Mexico were not available to Spanish speakers in the U.S., and that, created an opportunity, you felt, in the employer community in America.
Yeah, I mean, it was really kind of fascinating. As we're, You know, first it was the nonprofit focused on HIV. Then we created the for-profit focused on corporate wellness, and we're doing and that company was growing. We were getting more and more companies to join. But as I was talking to companies and looking around at what was happening in Mexico, what I saw was that there were some solutions that were really popular. One of them was telehealth. I got to know the largest telehealth provider in Mexico. I saw they had at the time I think just under 5 million subscribers in Mexico. They were bigger at the time than any. You could take all the U.S. companies all together and add them up, and this company was bigger than those. And I thought, this is really weird. This new a new approach to healthcare. And when I started to dig in, I found the reason why. A couple things. One is, you know, they don't in Mexico. They didn't have the legacy infrastructure that we have. So a lot of the impediments to telemedicine moving quickly and growing quickly in the U.S. For example, state-based practice of medicine regulations. You've got to be regulated in the state, not where the doctor is or where the patient's feet are. I mean, it's crazy. Our system is a good system, but it's older, and there's a lot of people protecting turf. They didn't have that in Mexico. It's a national license. If you become a doctor, you're licensed in the country. Hispanics are mobile first. So the mobile phone was very common. They were comfortable using it, and they weren't accustomed to getting health care in another way. They don't have the Marcus Welby type model in their mind. And so they were open to a new approach. So all of those things caused it to grow faster.
So do American employers and the payers and providers who support them understand the size and special needs of the Hispanic population? You're certainly trying to be a missionary about that. How do they receive you?
I think it's increasing. It's getting better and better. I think what we're finding is that, for instance, in California is 40% Hispanic. And within California, Southern California, parts of Southern California where I live are 60% Hispanic, sometimes 70%. And, you know, so the companies that operate, in certain parts of the country, I think really understand that they need to take action to figure out a way to better address the health needs of their Spanish-speaking employees. So it's still an education process, because up until now, there haven't been a lot of solutions for Spanish speakers. And frequently, because there were no solutions, a lot of HR, you know, benefits directors just weren't fully aware of what the challenges were. So part of our job, you're right, Lisa, is to proselytize a bit, to educate people that number one, they need to look and make sure that they're meeting the needs of all of their employees, not just the English-speaking employees, number one. And then number two, that there are solutions in the marketplace that can help them. We're one, I can say Hosanna, but I'm sure over time there'll be others. And so it's a process that's gaining steam. And one thing that has helped us dramatically is when Mercer is the number one, I think they're the largest employee benefits consulting firm in the country. They've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of clients across the country, particularly big and small and medium size. They heard about Consejo Sano pretty early on, about over a year and a half ago, and they invited us in, said there's nothing like this in the marketplace. We want to work with you. So they did a deep dive, and their labs group, I'm going to give a shout out to Dr. David Kaplan at Mercer. He's fantastic. He saw early on, he said, we need this. Our clients need this. And so after about a year of work, we made a deal with Mercer. We're a preferred vendor for them. So they're introducing us to their corporate clients across the country. So that not only helps us to reach clients, but it also creates additional credibility for our solution. So I'm grateful to Mercer for that partnership.
So I think about the Hispanic population. I think it's certainly not one group of people. It's many groups, you know, Mexican and California perhaps, but there's Puerto Ricans and Dominicans and, you know, you name it. So how much do those differences play a role in what you do? How much does cultural differences from America play a role in what you do? You know, is that built into the solution?
Yeah, you're right. It is an important factor. And we think that both language and culture are really important. And so Consejo Sano, our goal is to be, we said we want to be the front door for healthcare for Hispanics in the U.S., regardless of the country, original country of origin for a Hispanic person. If you're Hispanic, and particularly if you're a Spanish speaker, we want to be the trusted front door. You always come to us. And we can help navigate you. We can solve simple problems and then navigate you, help you to figure out what the next thing to do is. That's what Consejo Sano, that's what we're trying to, that's the company we're trying to build, that front door for Hispanics. But what that means is that we need to be sensitive to the cultural differences, because you're right, the Hispanic community in the U.S. is not monolithic. There, you know, as you said, there's, you know, Argentinians to Dominicans to Cubans, Puerto Ricans. There's all sorts of it's a diverse community. So as a new company, you know, we're still relatively new. We wanted to focus on the biggest part of the demographic. So just to get a sense of perspective, out of all the Hispanics in the U.S., a full two-thirds, about 66%, are from Mexico. So as a company launching into the U.S., introducing our new service, because we are both linguistically and culturally perfectly attuned to that demographic, we think we're in a good place to start. And we are also adding in additional cultural understanding so that we can, for instance, if we're serving clients in Florida, we're more sensitive to Cuban and for instance, Puerto Rican cultural issues. But we think we are starting at a good place, number one, with covering two-thirds, and that we are sensitive as we go forward, that we want to make sure that we're hitting and understanding the cultural nuances and differences within the Hispanic community.
So let me just pull back and ask sort of a broader question. So you started off, or at least you spent a lot of time in policy at the state level, as well as, you know, sort of in a way, some of these national projects. And then you sort of joined the private sector where, you know, you've been really working on this, you know, very promising company that you've described. When you start to, you know, particularly over the last couple of, maybe you could even say this election season, I can imagine a real question coming up as what's the opportunities or phrased differently, is your effort to impact people's lives through the private sector impacted by some of these almost like meta issues that seem to be happening nationally or at the public sector, or less, you know, in a more direct way? Do some of the comments coming out of the Trump campaign impact what you're trying to achieve in your business?
The way I would respond to that is I have more than once had conversations with prospective clients who have said to me, because of the tone of the last, say, you know, of this presidential election, as a company, they want to do something affirmative for their Spanish-speaking employees. It's really been gratifying to me, and I don't bring it up. They bring it up, and they say, yes, this is the right thing to do in terms of making sure that we are treating our Spanish-speaking employees equal to our English-speaking employees. Most of our corporate clients, I'll focus on those for the moment, they have robust health plans. You know, they're doing a good, they've got a benefit plan they designed for their employees, and they're proud of it. They're doing a good job, but it's English-focused. And for their Spanish speakers, they feel like they're giving them almost kind of a second-class solution because they're not really, it's not equal to what the English speakers are getting. So they, number one, want to be fair, and they want to, you know, to make sure they're meeting the needs of the entire employee family. So that's the first thing. The second thing is they do want to be an employer of choice. They want, given the demographic and how it's growing, they want to make sure that their company is perceived of as a good company for Hispanics to work at. But then the third thing, and this is I've been hearing, and I actually find it gratifying, many of these folks say to me, look, they're human beings too. They're saying, I see what's on the news, I hear what's happening, and I want my company, I want us to do something affirmative. I want to make sure that in a small way, we're sending the opposite signal, that we're doing something meaningful for our Spanish speakers. So I hate to say it, in a weird way, Trump is kind of driving people to, in some ways, want to do more to demonstrate they're different from him.
But one last very, very quick question. Were you tempted to join Bill Weld's libertarian candidacy? I think he's on the vice presidential, he's the vice presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party. Was that something that you considered, or is it a different phase of your life?
I'm focused on Consejo Sano, so I'm in a different phase of my life. But I will say that Bill Weld is one of the smartest, most progressive, and talented public leaders that I have ever met in my life. And I think that people, you know, should certainly take a look at him. I don't know Johnson as well, but I can tell you Bill Weld, you know, there's no better person that you'll ever find in public life than Bill Weld.
That's certainly my experience when I'm in Massachusetts for the many years I was. So I resonate with you on that.
Well, Adam, it was so interesting to talk to you. And I really, as you know, I'm a big admirer of what you're doing. And both because I think it's important socially, but moreover, because it's a great business opportunity. And I think so often people overlook the quote unquote niche populations for what they are, which is fabulously large business opportunities.
Not so niche, right?
And so I'm grateful you for coming on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Great spending time with both of you.
Take care.
Bye.
Abner Mason is the CEO of Consejo Sano, a company that delivers telemedicine, chronic care management, and navigation services, all delivered by native Spanish-speaking Hispanic doctors. It's a program whose time has come, no matter what your politics.
That was such an interesting conversation and really uplifting. I mean, it was even interesting that so much of the national conversation that we hear this year has been, you know, sort of this is such negativity and such distrust. And it's interesting that his program is really is able to capture the underlying desire of people to try to do something good.
Build a bridge instead of a wall.
Exactly. Thank you, Lisa.
Well, thank you so much for listening today. We're excited about the shows we have upcoming. And in the meantime, you can follow David Shaywitz's writing at Forbes.
And you can follow the inimitable Lisa Soonan at VentureValkyrie.com, as well as on the Timmerman Report.
We're grateful to our sponsor, DNA Nexus, the secure and compliant cloud platform that enables enterprise users to analyze, collaborate around, and integrate massive amounts of genetic and other health data.
Tectonics is produced by Connected Social Media and recorded in Tectonic Studio B in foggy Mill Valley, California. Take care.
Hasta la vista.